right, let's go ahead and get started. We should, I should start out by explaining that we all may appear on YouTube. Thanks to your work. Okay, nodded here. My name is Hannah Riley Bowles. I am the research director here at the Women in Public Policy Program. Here we are dedicated to closing gender gaps in economics, political participation, health, and education. We've had this wonderful series going on this year, and I'm thrilled here to have today another fabulous speaker. Now, are we formally co-hosting today's with? Yes, and today's speaker is formally co-hosted with the program on negotiation at Harvard Law School. We couldn't just, there are too many people who want a piece of you, Kathy. So we're thrilled today to have Kathy Phillips, who is the Paul Colello, is that right? Professor Colello, okay, professor of leadership and ethics at Columbia Business School. Kathy is a renowned scholar and much loved person in the field, and she's someone who studies, you know, what the value that diversity can bring to organizations and then some of the barriers to achieving, gaining that value. And lately she's been doing research also increasingly kind of at the intersection of race and gender, which has been a kind of theme throughout this year for us, particularly in collaboration with the program on negotiation. And we are just thrilled to have you here today. Thank you. And she's going to speak on, can female leaders mitigate negative effects of diversity, the case of national leaders? And we hope the answer is yes.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the invitation to come and speak with you all. I understand that you all may have questions as we go through the talk, so I do hope that you will raise your hand liberally if there's something that's not clear or if you have a question. Just interrupt me. And my hope is that we'll get through it all by the time that we're done, but if nothing less, I'm sure you will walk away with a lot to think about after this talk. One of my goals is always to challenge people to think even more about these issues of diversity and gender than I, you know, can do on my own. So you will all, hopefully, I will encourage you all and motivate you all to do even more and better work than what you'll see here today. This work that I'm doing here is in collaboration with Susan Perkins and Nicholas Pierce. And Susan happens to be here in the room today. She's sitting right here in the front. When we were together on the faculty at Kellogg, we started having some conversations that led us down the path of this research. I've been doing research, like Hannah said, on diversity for quite a while, and trying to understand how can you actually get all the value out of diversity that's purportedly there, recognizing that there can be some downsides to diversity and some upsides. And on the one hand, you can imagine having an approach that says, okay, let's focus on the positives and try to understand how to get those positives to come out. So I've done research that's looked at, you know, putting people together in the team environment and what are the factors that are necessary for getting their unique knowledge and information out on the table. But I'm also very aware of those downsides that people oftentimes talk about. So I've been involved, I'm calling this negative effects of diversity 1.0, and we'll get to 2.0 in a second. But the idea here is that diversity in groups, especially at this side of the literature where I've been mostly focused, is really, you know, you have less cohesion, less liking in these diverse environments, increased emotional conflict. And I'm making a kind of a broad brush here. This is a very, very vast and broad literature. And these papers that I'm citing here are all reviews of the literature. And there are others that I'm not citing here that have reviewed the literature and that have shown kind of time and time again that you can get and see some of these negative effects of diversity that are all very much explained by two broad theories, kind of social categorization and similarity attraction theories, that explain why this is happening. You have in-group and out-group and all of these dynamics, right, that come in diverse environments that lead to these negative things. Most of our conversations in the literature on the organizational side has really been rooted in interpersonal dynamics within these diverse groups, right? So it's about how much do I like you, essentially, right? We don't like each other. We're not attracted to one another. And recently, me and my colleagues have a paper that was just accepted at Organization Science It's titled, you know, it's kind of like getting to know each other at the company party. And this idea that organizations are constantly putting into place these opportunities for people to get to know each other with an underlying hope that it will help combat some of these negative effects of diversity, right? That people will get to know each other better and that things will be okay, right? We found in this paper that, well, these company parties and things, they do tend to make people feel closer to each other, but not nearly as much for people who are racially different from one another as opposed to people who are the same, right? So very much consistent with the idea that this is not really working that well, and that, in fact, there may be more underlying that we're not talking about in the organizational literature, more underlying these issues of why we're getting these negative effects of diversity that aren't really being talked about. And that's where we go to negative effects of diversity kind of 2.0. So there was this paper that Nancy DiTommaso, who's a sociologist, and her colleagues wrote that really kind of was a chastisement of sorts of literature, that in fact we have been kind of glossing over with our focus on these interpersonal things, kind of the more socio-structural issues that come with diversity, right? That in fact, diversity and inequality, when we think about this, there's a lot of inequality in diverse environments. There's issues of status and power and numbers, right, that drive the relationships between people in these organizations. And while we're focusing on letting people get along and have a good time, we're not recognizing the socio-structural background that's there that very much may be underlying the real cause of these symptoms that we see of people not getting along and liking each other and having, you know, more problems. Okay, so I thought to myself, after, you know, kind of digging into this a little bit, trying to keep up with the literature, what do we need to be thinking about with respect to this source of problems? How can we measure them, understand them, really start to have a conversation about them? And so I go to negative effects of diversity 2.0, and I said, well, what are the negative effects of diversity that come from these socio-structural things that we need to think about? So things like perceived and actual inequities, right? That in the organization, some people are making it up the ladder and other people aren't. And people are aware of that in the organizational environment. And that, in fact, may be in the backdrop causing problems. Disenfranchisement, the lack of empowerment, a lack of voice, lack of engagement of all members, right? So when I started talking to Susan about this, we realized that, like, there was a conversation in the kind of political economics world about diversity, but they called it ethnic fractionalization. Okay? Ethnic fractionalization, right? That at the country level, people have talked about things like disenfranchisement, lack of voice, lack of participation from multiple groups of people in these countries that have a lot of diversity. So I thought, wow, you know, I got introduced to people like Alicina and La Ferreira, started reading their work, and I saw that they were actually citing some of my work. And I thought, oh, wow, this conversation is happening in this other part of the world, but talking about the same thing, just at a different level of analysis. And because I had Susan there on the faculty with me, we found that we had perhaps a natural way to kind of bring our interests together. So you think about this perceived and actual inequities, disenfranchisement, and they have shown in that literature that this ethnic fractionalization is very closely related to performance at the country level. That GDP growth is actually undermined in countries that have a lot of ethnic fractionalization, that there's a negative relationship between those two. Right? So I thought, okay, we think about this diversity at the country level, the ethnic fractionalization, I'm going to call it EF, so I don't have to keep, okay? It's a cross-country comparative diversity measure, reflects the number of ethnic groups within a country and the probability that a fellow countryman is of a different ethnic group. So, you know, when you're walking down the street, how much diversity do you see, do you experience in your life? And there's a lot of, you know, quite a few papers there that have shown that this ethnic fractionalization is associated with negative economic development at the country level, okay? So I thought to myself, let's go to the country level and really think about how can you start and what can we do to try to mitigate the negative effects of this diversity? Go ahead,
Hannah. I'm just trying to figure out, like, the U.S. as compared to Europe or something like that. I mean, wouldn't the U.S. be much higher on this? Is it like an outlier or is it a...
No. I'll give you a sense of the variation, okay. One of the slides going forward to kind of get a sense. But it varies from 0 to 1, and I think the U.S. is about 0.41, okay, I was going to say 0.39, but 0.41, okay? So the U.S. kind of is not very diverse, okay, but it certainly has some more diversity than, like, Germany or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as we started talking about this and thinking about the source of this negative effects 2.0, where does this come from? And how can you try to mitigate those negative effects of diversity? I had also been doing work on gender and trying to understand the effects of female leadership and seeing what was happening there. And a hypothesis occurred to us. I'm just going to lay out the premise and then back into where we might get the support for that premise to see if I can bring you along with me with this hypothesis, right? So this is our premise. Leadership matters, first of all. You have to believe that leadership matters for country performance. Leadership matters. You don't have to convince people so much of this at the organizational level or at the team level. Leadership matters. But leadership also matters at the country level. And there have been people who have done research on this. Jones and Olkin and their colleagues have done things. And our hypothesis is that female leaders may be especially fit to combat the negative effects of diversity, these negative effects 2.0, the perception and actual inequities between groups that may be there, the disenfranchisement and lack of voice that people feel like they have in environments that are diverse. How can women perhaps help with those things? Is there a particularly good fit for women to deal with those environments as opposed to men? And what do we know about the different leadership styles that might lead us to that conclusion? Right? Is everybody with me? Yeah? All right. So here's some research, and it's not all of it, right? So I think it would take me too long to review all of the literature on gender and feminine leadership styles and things. But ultimately, where we are and what we understand about this is that females are expected and shown, right, to lead in a more cooperative, more democratic fashion, right? This whole idea of transformational leadership. They're more inspiring. They are more, kind of communal in the way that they lead, right? More warm, et cetera. And then there's been this recent model by Van Voot and Spisak and others that have argued that there's kind of a contingency model of leadership such that there is, in fact, evidence that followers expect more masculine leadership when they're dealing with a competitive environment. So they've looked at, for instance, if you have cross-country wars, you know, you expect a man to step in there and deal with that kind of competitive environment. Whereas when you think that there's cooperation needed between groups, people look for a woman. And they've done these studies where they've shown that even if you just change the features of a person's face to make the face more masculine or more feminine, they'll make choices that fit the what they see to be the needs of that environment. So if it's the more competitive needs, they choose a man. If it's the more cooperative needs, they choose a woman. So you can imagine then that if you're in a diverse environment and people feel like we have inequities, we have no voice, we need to have some cooperation here and some opportunity for everybody to get involved, that they might then say a woman might fit that better. Okay? And when given choice, people choose leaders that fit that adaptive problem faced in that setting. Okay? From another perspective, at the team level, there's been recent research that has shown that women tend to score higher on things like social sensitivity. And the social sensitivity is being able to kind of read people's feelings and emotions, but also concerns about inclusiveness and taking turns. So what they found in these studies is they did a series of interactions where a team would come in and they would work on multiple tasks, right? All kinds of different tasks, right? And as they worked across these tasks, they tried to understand what is it that helped the team perform well on these various different types of tasks. And what they found was that ultimately the things that predicted how well the team performed across these different tasks was things like how inclusive people were, how equal the turn-taking was in the environment. And it turned out that the more women that were in that group, the more likely you were to have the turn-taking and things be more equal, right? The argument here is that collective intelligence leads to better overall group performance, that having those women there helps us to work together, right, more equally. Do you have a question? No. Okay. All right, so, and this is, you know, this is one paper on that team level side. There's another piece that I don't have here on the slides that actually my postdoc, Nagin Tusi, and her colleagues have done, where they looked at teams, people working in teams, and they particularly looked at women, white women, in these team environments. And what they found was when the team was homogeneous with respect to race, okay, when it was kind of an all-white group, that the women didn't participate very much. There was gender diversity, they didn't hear the women. But when they put them in a racially diverse environment, those white women participated more in the discussion, in the conversation. It changed, again, the nature of that, of the inclusiveness that woman felt, which, again, also gives some suggestion that maybe that in a diverse environment, the woman will kind of step in a different way than she might in a more homogeneous environment. Yes? Yes.
Was it only the white women who participated more in the racial?
They didn't have very many. They didn't have enough kind of ethnically diverse women to really test it, right? Yeah, which is oftentimes part of the problem when you're working in this space, right, and trying to get real data to speak to these issues, especially real behavioral data, getting the right people into the lab at the right time, et cetera, tough.
Because what might that suggest that women are speaking more because they feel a sense of superiority that they don't feel in the mixed gender hallway?
Absolutely. That, in fact, there is a, you think about the where does perceived inequities come from, right, and these issues of status and things, that, in fact, those white women may feel like, I'm not a low-status person in this environment, and I actually do have space to have some voice here that they do not feel, right, when they're with their, you know, kind of same-race men, right? Yes?
Going with your premise, would the following two observations also be true? The first one is, female leaders might be good for people who kind of care about diversity or care about the collective team, etc., but might be threatening. People who like the inequities, the status differences, mm-hmm. and so that should also probably affect them. And then my second concern is related to some of your earlier work, and that is for this to work, it requires that people on the team actually care about the outcome. Because mm-hmm. I remember from your early work, that's always struck me so badly. I mean, whenever I talk about this, is, and I hope I remember it correctly, that people don't like, they don't enjoy
the work.
And so I'm part of an organization, and yes, the organization might benefit from it, and yes, you know, in 500 years, my salary might depend on what our group just did.
Right.
But I am suffering here, not enjoying myself.
Absolutely. So to answer both of those questions, I agree with you on both of these accounts, right, that let me start with the second one first, because I think it's very clear that, in fact, you know, the performance that we're talking about here in all of these cases, these were teams that were brought together to do a task, to actually, you know, accomplish something. They were getting paid not extra money for doing it, but that's what they were there for, right? They were there to perform the task. And so they cared about the outcome to the extent that they were, you know, going to participate at all. They cared about the outcome. And, in fact, in order for diversity to have that positive effect, right, what happens is people participate in these team environments and they don't really feel good to them, is what I was just referring to some of my past work, where people get into the diverse environment, they have a little more conflict. They think a little harder than they do in the homogeneous environment. We, you know, have good evidence to show that people are actually processing information more deeply when they're in the diverse environment. But if you ask them, how did it go, right? How did it feel to them? How effective do they think they were? And even how confident are they that they have the right answer? They say, not so much so, right, in the diverse environment. So there is kind of a tricky situation here, and it doesn't go away in this situation. Absolutely not, right? It doesn't go away. It's the same thing. Like, do I, in fact, enjoy? No, maybe I don't want to be led by this person. Speak to the first point you're talking about. I have a line of research that's very related to this that we've been working on that looks at the status of a leader and what the status of that leader is when they rise to that position. So is it a low-status person coming up through the group and rising to the top, or is it a high-status person rising to the top? Okay, now what we know, what we were hypothesizing, is that when a low-status person rises to the top, the low-status people are really happy about that, right? And it empowers them, and it makes them feel like they want to really, you know, they can try and they can make it, right? There's some evidence of this. Sometimes people have looked at this, the Obama effect. There's some pros and cons on whether or not, you know, some positive and negative results with respect to that. We've been trying to, like, take that out of this larger context and say, what about in organizations? Does it matter if an African-American rises to the top of the company? What does it matter to the people that are there, you know? Will it actually change their behavior, make them work harder, et cetera, okay? So we have some evidence that, in fact, low-status people do feel more empowered when that low-status person rises. In the first study we did not find it to have a negative effect on the high-status people. High-status people said, whatever, I'm still good. And they still participated. They still did what they had done when they had a high-status leader that rose to the top. Didn't really matter to them. We ran a second study, and the high-status people didn't like it. They didn't like that this low-status person had risen to the top. What's that about? How could that be? It's undermining, you know, my position. So there was more concern expressed. So we're still working on that, right? And I do think that that it may matter how much people actually believe in the system that the person came up through, right? How much they buy into the status hierarchy itself. Do they think that that's a legitimate real status hierarchy as it relates to the problem that they're working on, right? And so I think there's a number of things that need to be taken into consideration. And I also think that there will be resistance. Every time change happens, there's resistance. And so I don't see this as any different than that. So people who have power or are in high status positions and then find themselves no longer in that position, they're not going to like it very much. I wouldn't like it. Right? I think it's kind of a natural reaction. And so I don't think we should expect that people will necessarily, you know, stand up and sing Kumbaya, take everything I have. They, you know, people will be resistant. Right? Yes.
Maybe this is another way to think about Iris's question, which is in your, so your suggestion is that with the higher fractionalization, women leaders are going to help perform better because they're going to step in and perform this cooperative glue type of role. But you could imagine with higher fractionalization, if you have people seeking, so your hypothesis is not about whether they seek more, whether they're more likely to interpret that fractionalization as a reason for competition and therefore seek the male leader or the masculine type leader,
right.
Versus what they think, you know, how to solve their current fractionalization is to have more glue and more inclusiveness, and
right.
So therefore they would be more likely to seek a female leader. You actually don't have a
right.
hypothesis about that. You just have a hypothesis about the interaction
right.
leading to a better outcome.
Yeah, that's
right?
true. That's true. And in fact, that I think as we think about the reasons why this could be happening, I think there's also a lot of plausible, especially when you get to the, you're talking about the country level of this, right? And so the effect, is it just a potentially just a symbolic effect? So once she's in that leadership position, now it's not necessarily about everything that she's doing, but it's about what other people start to do, right, in that environment that may also be getting affected by her being there, right? So if a woman rises to the top and we know that, like, and we have in our heads, oh, women care more about cooperation and they care more about inclusiveness, and then when I'm making a decision down here as policy manager X, perhaps the decisions that I'm making, even if I'm a man, may start to change, right? May start to be influenced by her presence, right? And so I think that there's a, you know, multiple paths that perhaps might lead to some changes that we would see in this context. Right? Okay. Let me see. I think I have one more organizational level effects here. Desno and Ross have this paper that came out in 2010. I believe it's in Management Science, where they looked at top management teams of the largest 1,500 U.S. public corporations over a 15-year period. And they had data on whether the top management team had a woman or not, had women or not in the top management team. And they found that female representation in the top management team improved the firm performance. And they used all of these measures of firm performance, Tobin's Q and all this stuff. This was especially so in highly complex environments, right, where they wanted really high innovation and there was a lot of need for human interaction, human assets environments, which again kind of speaks to the notion that there may be something about having these women in these particularly complex, difficult situations where more collaboration is needed, right?
Do we know from that data whether females are more likely to be selected after
right.
the firm has been, after the
yeah.
the guys screwed it up?
Yeah. So there is a line of work in both of these cases. So I think on my next slide, I have like a caution about causation line. So, you know, with work like this, with work like the work that I'm going to present to you, it's always a question of which direction does the arrow go, right? Is there something about, you know, these highly complex environments finding themselves failing, and so they are the ones that then choose a woman to come in, and then once she comes in, you get some regression to the mean performance improvement that then is attributed to the woman, right, to having the woman there.
And the selection is interesting in that.
Yeah, and is the woman selected in? So the reverse causation conversation, I think, is one that I have to acknowledge, and that is very much, you know, we could talk about how plausible it is or not, but that's one that I've heard time and time again to kind of explain these findings. I'm sure you're nodding your head like, yeah, we've heard that lots of times. There's also the question of selection. So there's the research that Ryan and Haslam and others have done that's called the glass cliff effect. And the idea here is that women are selected into, and actually some evidence that women might choose to be in environments that are perhaps more precarious, where they are really difficult positions to be in, where things are not going very well. you know, of course, there's the question of, well, what opportunities do they get? If this is all they're getting, that's what they find themselves stepping into. So they might be selected into these environments that are precarious because people believe that they can actually deal with them better.
And you're saying, Mike, do we know whether
there? So there is some research evidence to suggest that that's true, right? To suggest that's true, that women face a glass cliff more than men do, right? And there was a recent paper in Psychological Science that actually showed that when women are looking at this negative environment, they told them some information about what was good about the situation. Either talked about the social resources that they would have going in, the financial resources they would have going in, or both. And what they found was that women paid more attention to and selected themselves into situations more where the social resources were intact, right? Where you have support from other people, et cetera. And men were more focused on the financial resources being intact. They didn't care if the social resources were there. As long as the financial resources were there to do it, they were more likely to choose it. It's a really interesting paper. Yeah. Okay. So let's go to the experiments. To the data. So we did, for this project, we did two experiments, and we have the national data that we'll show you. And what we wanted to do was, first of all, get a sense of what do people think about this? Like, does this premise even make sense to them, and how are they making these associations? So we gave people, like, a little article. This is a Time magazine article. We dated and everything. And we made up a fictitious country called Elmoa. And we said, who will be Elmoa's next president? And the article basically goes on to say, you know, changes in the air. Mr. David Markova and Ms. Marcia Everly are both poised to assume the presidency. So this is an election that's about to happen between these two candidates, David and Marcia, a man and a woman. And the election, it says change is inevitable and in the hands of the people because the last president has to leave because of constitutional term limits. Okay? So there will be a new president. It's either going to be David or it's going to be Marcia. And then we tell them a little bit about the country, Elmoa, about its being diverse or being less diverse. And then there's just a little closing statement here. So what we did with the manipulation is we just said, look, Elmoa is a country that historically has been very ethnically diverse. There are over 20 different groups represented, and we, you know, some of them live in the West, some of them live in the East, and give a little information like that. In the low ethnic diversity, we said Elmoa is a country that historically has not been very ethnically diverse. There's one kind of dominant group and a couple of smaller groups, and go on to say a little bit about them. And this is the manipulation. This is all we did in this first study. Does it matter if the country is diverse or less diverse? Who do the people choose? What do they think about you know, how difficult it'll be to lead the country? Just kind of a manipulation check. The manipulation worked really well. Everybody recognized it was more diverse or less diverse. But they said it would be really difficult to lead this highly diverse country, okay, as opposed to a low ethnically diverse country. So then we asked them, what percentage of the people who live in this country, right, should choose this person to be the next president, the woman or the man? And we got basically this whopping main effect. And we thought, oh, this is just, we just got like a lot of social desirability here. People are just saying that they should elect a woman, and maybe that's all that's going to happen in this data, and we don't really have much to say, right? Because it didn't really matter if you were in the ethnically diverse or not, high or low, they chose the woman, okay? They said they should select this woman. But then we asked them also, who do you think will be the most effective leader, right? So this is the percentage of people choosing the candidate as the most effective to lead this country. And here we did find an effect. Sorry, I'm falling off of the picture here. But in my high ethnically diverse situations, people said the woman much more than the man. So we had an interaction effect here where it really did matter in the ethnically diverse environment, the high ethnic diversity, that's where they thought the woman would be more effective. Yes?
The people making this judgment, what was their background?
Oh, sorry. I thought I would be pressed, a little bit more pressed for time. This was a national sample. That we did online, so this was online. It was a national sample of people, about 100 people in this sample. They were average age about 34, 35 years old. There was a little bit higher percentage of women. Okay, so it was a little bit more dominated by women. And all of the analysis we controlled for who was answering, was it a woman or a man, what their race was. We also, when we presented this, we counterbalanced if they saw the man or the woman first as an option so that we could see if they were just choosing the first one, and we controlled for that, and the effects remain robust, right? So we see this.
Were you surprised by the man? I mean, we're like stunned, both are like, whoa, maybe the world's a votes.
I mean, that's not how people vote.
It's not how people vote because they oftentimes don't have a choice to vote. I mean, if you look at the actual percentage of women out there in the world that have run for election for the national leadership position in a country, the numbers are really small. They don't have it as an option oftentimes. Was I surprised by it? You know, no. My hypothesis was that people would, in fact, see that in this high ethnically diverse environment, they would.
So the U.S. data is that when women and men run for office, open seat to open seat, challenger to challenger, incumbent to incumbent, women win within 1 percentage point of men in all categories and slightly more. But we have this election effect of who makes it through the gauntlet of the primary and the other processes. That woman is likely to be much more qualified than the male counterpart.
Absolutely.
But even setting that aside,
yeah,
we don't
still
see
doesn't.
This large effect, though, that you know, the data changes, particular race changes, level of office changes, executive. But so that effect really stands as an outlier for what we see actually taking place, which makes it quite a curiosity.
So I think I would say a couple things. One is that I think as we think about the U.S. as a diverse country, I don't think the U.S. is nearly as diverse as the environment that we framed here. We like to think of the U.S. as a very diverse country, and there's a lot of conversation here about the diversity of the country, but as I mentioned before, the ethnic fractionalization measure for the U.S. puts it at about 4.1, which is below the mean. Actually, the average is about 4.46 or so.
And at some point in your talk, I would love to hear what your perceptions are of what this will mean going forward, since we'll be, as a nation, majority in 2050.
Yeah.
And if we look at the disparity of voting pattern, for example, as well, and by parties, it's
fascinating
to imagine your research in relation to that.
Absolutely. And I also think it really, like, for instance, you can imagine a study, if we had the data, right, where you could look at this information by community. So where do women win? Maybe they are winning in the environments that are more diverse.
Mm-hmm.
When they do win, perhaps there are some features of that environment that's consistent with what I'm saying here, that's going to happen more in situations in the cities and in the, you know, in communities that are more diverse, right, would be my hypothesis. But I don't know. We don't have that data. It'd be great to have it. I mean, and if you know someone who has it, like, love to talk to them about it.
We kind of have that data, and we know that the Democrats do significantly better in ethnically diverse communities, rural or urban. And we know that women both run and win more effectively within the Democratic Party for a whole variety of reasons.
So it's interesting because it would be nice to do a series of studies to try to understand what's the reason for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to actually try to use this hypothesis or this understanding of the literature to dig deeper into why does that happen exactly?
And in part that happens because the policies on how do you become policy divide, particularly in such an ideological time period. Like
right now,
it's one can really see a policy component to it as opposed to it really being social preferences.
I think the other thing that's really important here is that there's a whole lot of stuff being held constant in an experiment like this one, right? So, like, the complexities that you're talking about, people aren't asking, well, what, you know, we're not saying anything about what political parties or how many political parties, like, we're not saying anything about that. And so it's very much stripped down in the sense that you get to see, like, well, you know, I have this ethnically diverse environment and I want to think who's going to be most effective. I think it's going to be a woman. Like, people, that's what people are saying to us. So, okay, I'm going to go this way around the room.
Do you think if the question was about a man from a minority group and a woman as a woman, does it change something? Because it can be also people saying, in a diverse environment, it's better to have somebody from a minority.
Yeah.
And then the woman is associated with the minority, maybe.
Yeah, in people's heads, yeah. So we very much have a hypothesis about this. And in fact, when we first started this project, our goal was to collect all of the, both the gender and the ethnicity data about all the leaders around the world. It's impossible. I mean, it was like an impossible task, even just trying to understand what does ethnicity mean in each of these countries and how do you actually measure that and how is it reported and is it reported was just too difficult to do. So in fact, we did have a hypothesis and we still do have a hypothesis and you know, we'll be moving forward, right, on trying to understand, does it matter if they come from the dominant group that we represented here or from the minority group that we represented here, and will you get similar effects? So you can imagine the logic could be that it's just not just the gender effect, but it's the status effect, which is why we're doing the other work on status, right? Okay, yes.
So I think this would be very interesting for political campaigns to think about how they, women candidates, want to frame their campaign. They might want to focus in their campaign messaging, this is a very diverse world,
right.
We need people who can handle that kind of thing.
Right.
Because how you did this was just framing it two different ways, high diversity, low diversity.
Yep.
So I think it's good political implication.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I really like that because, in fact, you might convince everybody that's listening that, yeah, you know, there's something that I can bring to this diversity that we have here if we get people to focus on that. Yeah. Tina?
The word frame is exactly what I was thinking about. So, Victoria, when you said you have the primaries and then you have the actual election, they have to run the gauntlet. A gauntlet is very competitive. And so what's interesting to me is that it could be, given your hypotheses, that men are viewed as more qualified to run that gauntlet, which is why women don't often get to the election phase. So then, sort of, when we're talking about framing, I'm thinking it would be very interesting, not just for the candidates, but for policymakers, right? How do we frame the political arena? Is it about, we say things like, there's lots of elbows, we have to get ahead, they have to beat, they have to win. What would happen if we change it to say things like, let's help, how can this election help the community? How can it assist others? Mm-hmm. It would be very interesting. I mean, that's a study, Kathy.
Yeah, no, I'm getting it. I'm getting it. You see, I'm right. We on it.
Yeah.
Yes, in the back. Okay.
Another interesting factor would be age. Age of the respondents and whether age exists in any way in terms of the candidates. I mean, I know you all the things but I think that's been
very important. Okay, great. Thank you. Yes.
Would you have a U-shape or an inverted U-shaped hypothesis so that in sort of the super high ethnic fractionalization that you have, this is what you'd find.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say there's sort of this, not, and then the other side is actually a very stable situation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dominant with
right,
several majorities.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you could imagine diversity. So I think in the political science literature, and I'm blanking on the name, this is my old IR hat coming, there is actually this notion of a U-shaped curve with fractionalization related to war and conflict.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you might even imagine a situation where there's a medium level,
right?
Where
so,
they expect there to be a lot of ideological splitting. And
So with that, Van Voot's work, and I think this is part of the reason why we haven't completely gone there, I think his work really speaks to that, right? He hasn't framed it quite in that way, but what he has framed is, are we dealing with intra-group competition or inter-group competition? And the way that he's framing it is, you know, within that country, if we have intra-group competition happening, a woman should be perceived as more useful. But if we are, as a country, trying to fight other people, then we want a man. That's what he's been looking at. So I think it's kind of related to what you're saying, and I would want to think about it and juxtapose all those pieces together to make sure there's, you know, kind of how to get the contribution in there around that. But I think that that's very, very worth looking at. And the two extremes that we used here, right, we spend a lot of time thinking about how do you frame a country to have less ethnic diversity? Do you want it to just be everybody's exactly the same? And it was like, that's kind of weird. It just seemed too extreme, right, to have it completely homogeneous. But I think there certainly is a wide range between what we showed on these two extremes that can be tested, right, all along the continuum there, right?
I kind of made me think also about, is it the number of ethnic minorities or is it the number of ethnicities that's most? So if you have 30% ethnic minorities, does it matter if it's 30% of the same ethnic minorities or 10% this, 10% this, 10% that?
So
maybe think about with women doing better in democratic elections, partly it's just a function of there's more minorities.
Right.
If there's an independent thing where the mix of minorities over and above that,
right,
that would be.
Yeah, no, I think that that's an interesting question.
But maybe men can handle two groups.
Right, but they can. Yeah. We can't really disentangle that, you know, with what we have here because we, you know, we said, oh, there's 20 different groups.
Yeah.
But when we did that, though, let's see, I actually have a, can I somehow, I think I might have a hidden slide in here. Ah, don't worry. I think I can just remember it. the way that we manipulated this, when we told them that we had, that the country had 20 different, the country had 20 different groups, we said, you know, it had, let's say it was three groups were kind of named and given percentages, 15%, 17%, and 15%, and then a whole host of other things, right? And in the one where we had only, you know, a few different ethnic groups, yeah, we said, you know, there's a dominant group that's about, I don't know what number we use, but let's say it's 40%, and then it has these two other groups that are, you know, have a relatively reasonable percentage that you can actually put a percentage on, and then, you know, kind of, it kind of rounded out to add up to 95% or something like that. So in that sense, we highlighted for them that there were kind of three groups or so, and then a whole bunch of other people, and so I think that we could manipulate what you're talking about pretty easily with the paradigm that we've set up, right? So I think it'd be definitely worth looking at. Yeah.
Well, I don't think Todd Rogers is here, but he highlighted the fact in a lot of his work that that Kerry made a tragic mistake in 2004 when he highlighted the 38 million women that had voted in the prior election.
Okay.
And that created a norm. It was, social scientists could have told him this is a really bad thing to do.
Right, right.
And pulling Susan's comment, I think there's a norm for female and African-American candidates to say, I'm a candidate for all the people.
People, right.
And mm-hmm. to reduce their identity to their gender or race. And and sort of picking up on Susan's comments and your research,
yeah.
There's a possibility that that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
That there are predictable contexts in which
right.
you want some of the social identity
mm-hmm.
connected to gender or race
yep.
to help you, and that would be something that
really
would be
interesting.
Very
yeah.
doable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's interesting because I'm thinking all about Obama and is he black enough and you know all this stuff, right? It's lots of conversations and you know. it's an interesting question because I certainly have had over time as I've been doing a lot of this work, I examine myself a lot, right, and about how much I express my own identity. And you can imagine when I first started doing research in diversity, people kind of saying to me, "Are you sure you want to do that? You know, you realize that you're black, a woman." And I'm like, "Yeah, I have been and will be for the rest of my days. Like, there's not much I can do about that one."
But, surprise.
But there's, you know, kind of this sense that, like, you know, people will think that you're just doing me search and you're not, right? And so there is a question of how much do you use that identity, where and how do you use it, that I think people sometimes might underestimate the power of. So that would be really, really great research direction that maybe I could do with Rachel. Go ahead.
Yeah, but to your point, though, I actually wonder if highlighting it would be so beneficial, because then you give the, I mean, I think Obama, for example, has to kind of downplay his identity to an extent, because maybe if you're a minority male or you're a woman, you have greater potential to seem inclusive as long as you play up the ability to bring together lots of different people, but you also have a greater potential to seem exclusionary, like I only want to help other women or other minorities or something like that. So it's sort of you need to tap into one potential and not the other, so you can just as well easily maybe scare people off by emphasizing the minority identity more.
Yeah, so it's a tricky kind of like tightrope, right? That balancing act that has to be taken into consideration. But it's a ripe area for more research for sure. Let me just tell you this one other finding from this first study. We asked people, will your chosen president help improve ethnic inequities in this, you know, in the country? And again, we got an interaction effect where people thought that women would be better able to deal with that in this highly fractionalized situation. Okay, so then we did a second experiment, and we said this time, instead of having people choose, you know, which one should you go with, the man or the woman, we actually want to tell them that the woman won or the man won. So we are manipulating the gender of the president by saying, you know, Elmore's big election results are in, Deborah Markova or David Markova wins the presidential race. And the same manipulation of racial identity, of ethnic fractionalization is here. Just to give you a sense, Mike, I was trying to remember. It says for the low ethnic diversity, the largest group is the Abrin, 91%, and the rest of the population is split between the Brim and the Drone, right? So that's how that's set up. Okay. So now we have a 2x2 design, right, where we have high or low diversity of the country, and we have a man or a woman who has won. And we ask the same, pretty much the same questions. The first thing we asked was, how difficult will it be for this person to lead this country? Now, when I looked at this result initially, I was like, oh my gosh, this data's not coming out right. But if you think about this question, how difficult will it be to lead? It's going to be, again, we got a Whopping-Main effect. It's going to be difficult to lead in a highly fractionalized area as opposed to one that's less diverse, okay? But this interaction effect, even though it doesn't look really big, is actually significant, such that when it's highly diverse, people say it's gonna be even harder for a man, you know, is it gonna be even harder to lead when a man is the president than when a woman is the president? So we thought, there's still a little bit of evidence here that people see that perhaps a woman is going to be a little more fit for dealing with this highly difficult situation, right? And then we asked, will the president help improve ethnic inequities? And again, you see, this actually ends up being a main effect for gender there, so that you get a just general trends for women seeming like they will be able to help improve these inequities. And we didn't get the interaction effect so much here, okay? Will members of all ethnic groups feel empowered? So this we were trying to get into, like, how do you think this is going to affect how people are feeling about things? And again, you get that Whopping-Main effect for gender. You see a little bit of, but there's no difference. There's no interaction here either. So there was a main effect for gender, okay? And then the last question we asked them is, do you think the economic situation will actually improve in this country, right? Trying to get at people, trying to see if they're really getting this. And this was a marginally significant interaction. So there was no difference between men and women here. But there was a trend for women to be seen as being able to improve the economic outcomes more than men in this highly fractionalized area. Yeah.
So can I go back to your the numbers argument?
Yeah.
And then the idea of a dominant group.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, let's say you had South Africa, mm-hmm. where you have a dominant minority.
Right.
You know, and high ethnic. Does the distribution of the proportion of the ethnicity matter, or the existence of the dominant group? So I would think, kind of interesting maybe to play with that sometime, because mm-hmm. I think the existence mm-hmm. of a dominant group or a stark status hierarchy,
yeah.
And there are lots of countries that are run by a minority,
right?
You know, that where you might actually have you know, something, you might see favoritism toward male candidates because there would be you would project on them,
right?
Maintenance of status hierarchy and
right,
competition or something like that, or that like you were describing. Whether or not there's, you know, perceived competitiveness or
right,
whatever.
Right, right. So it's interesting because I guess if you were thinking, I would think that you certainly would have people perhaps having some differences in how they would respond.
Yeah, but so maybe like high SEO,
depending on who they are, right,
low
exactly,
SEO and stuff
right.
like that. But I was just thinking that the dominant itself might signal.
Yeah, no, I like that. And in fact, again, this paradigm that we've created here would be one that would probably make it pretty easy for us to do that, to kind of say, you know, even though this group is only, you know, 11% of the country, they have more wealth, they have more power, they have more resources than, you know what I mean? And kind of create that status hierarchy where you have a smaller group dominating, you know, in that more powerful position. Yeah, that would definitely be interesting. South Africa is always a unique case.
Well, Chinese and Malaysia.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few others.
Did you have a question back here? Yeah.
Is there any university or college for presidential to prepare women for presidential posts?
Yeah. Is there how do women kind of become presidents, or is there something that prepares them?
I'm wondering if I don't know if there is any special college for to train women for president.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well as, for example, I'm so much impressed and very happy to see women can lead like Hillary Clinton, like Nancy Pelosi,
right.
Like Michelle Obama.
Uh-huh.
These women are really, really very fascinating to me because I read their books.
Right.
And I always follow what they are doing, and I'm really so happy to see that.
Yeah.
It looks a fair more woman
right.
for that kind of a
job. Yeah. I agree. So one of the things that we know, and I'll talk about a little bit when we get to the national data, is kind of how do these women come to be
in these leadership roles? Who were they? You know, how did they get there? And there certainly is kind of a little bit of a history early on of women becoming in leadership positions because of their relationship with their spouses. So their spouse was the president, and he died, and then she becomes the president. Things like that happen. Actually, not rare. I mean, it happened enough for it to be really clear in the data. And then in other cases, she was elected because she had gone through, and maybe before she was the vice president, or she had been in some role that, in fact, kind of prepared her for that position. And so, yeah, there's definitely people tell me all the time, because right now, for instance, they have a quota that's been put into place in some of the Norwegian countries and things to actually have a certain percentage of women on their boards, 40% of women on the board, something like this. And there's conversation about, but they're not prepared, and they're hurting the boards and this kind of thing. I was actually doing an interview the other day, and somebody asked me, isn't that bad for us to do this because these people aren't prepared and blah blah blah. So I gave them my answer, diversity is beneficial, and you don't have to have a whole bunch of stars. In fact, some of the data suggested if you just have a whole bunch of stars sitting around, you're not necessarily going to get the best outcomes. But then I also said, let's have an example here. Let's say you have somebody who has been playing the cello for 50 years. They've been playing every day. They've been trained to play the cello as a concert celloist all their lives. They've been trained by the best. They've been told what to do. They've been held, hands been held every day. And then you have someone who picked up the cello and started trying to play it, and people told them, you can't really play that cello. You don't know what you're doing. You can't, what you doing? What do you think you're doing playing the cello, right? Not really getting the same kind of support or the same kind of training, trying to do it. If I put the two next to each other, why wouldn't you expect the one who got a lot of training and help to be better, right? So the notion that they have to be up to speed, have to be the same as these men, is that's ridiculous. And who's to say that they're doing it right anyway, right? I mean, maybe they were trying, maybe they had a bad technique. Maybe this person created a technique that was amazing that would have never been discovered because you keep doing it the same way for the last 50 years. Right? And so there's definitely a need for opportunity for women to blossom, for women to grow. But I don't believe that they necessarily need to be done the same way a man was done. Right? So, well, let me get off my high horse. Come on back down. Okay. So now we're going to move to the national stage. This is a wonderful timeline of, is this still up, Susan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh.
Do you think it would matter if the stakes were different? So maybe I'm comfortable saying, the woman would be better in this other country that I don't have to live in. She's not
Yeah.
People feel differently if it was you living in this country and she's going to be your leader.
Yeah. That's a great question. And again, another one that's pretty easy to test. I think I would say I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure. I think it would probably matter a lot of the... I would want a lot of individual difference understandings of people's kind of prejudices and things that they might have. But we know that everybody understands and knows what the stereotypes are about the way people lead and et cetera, and who they are and expectations about them. So I don't know. I kind of think that maybe we could get a similar effect, but maybe it wouldn't be as strong as what we found here. Maybe people will be a little more reluctant, not quite sure. Maybe it'll be more like the data that Victoria has been talking about where, she doesn't get there. She doesn't make it, right? Because people aren't willing to pull the ballot box when they get in there with their quiet space and they have to decide. They're like, do I want daddy to lead or mommy to lead? Mm-hmm. And they make use these stereotypes and things still to make their decision. So definitely worth trying. Yeah.
Like many of you, kind of on my Hillary Clinton sidelines. But I think of international policy and type of things like that and Secretary of State positions where you are dealing with the competition of the international community, but you're also obviously dealing with diverse populations. So I'm wondering, what trumps that in kind of looking at who would be better in dealing with international policies?
Right.
Does the diversity trump, or does the competition?
It's interesting because I think that the Secretary of State position in the United States has definitely become kind of gendered. Right? We've had quite a few women in that role. And I think that it's because perhaps correlated with the idea of the United States not being a bully anymore. We're not just trying to take over the world. And right. So I think it's interesting. I imagine that you could frame that Secretary of State position in different ways, kind of say, the U.S. has been under threat from these countries, et cetera, and I would bet people would choose a man. Or the U.S. is trying to collaborate with these other countries, you're part of the U.N. and blah, 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 and maybe people might see a woman as being more appropriate for the position. And so I think the Secretary of State position has been, for lack of a better word, kind of feminized. It's definitely worth kind of even seeing if there's the way that people write about it in the newspaper, for instance, may have changed over time, or, you know, depending upon who was in it. Maybe once the first woman is in there, it starts to change. And we know a lot about occupations and how occupations change and get feminized when more women start to come into the position. So it's a good question. It's a really interesting phenomenon. Okay, so we have this data set that we put together. Really a lot of work done by Susan and Nicholas Pierce to pull a data set together that basically looks at women and male leaders of countries across a 50-year period. And this is just, you know, a nice timeline that Susan actually put together. There's a website for this, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's still available?
I think it's called Timeline.
Timeline.
So we have it publicly.
Yeah, we can send you the website. I think it would be great to have people see this. Because I think basically all of them are here. And our data set doesn't go all the way to 2010. Our data set goes to 2004. Okay, so we have an archival data set of national leaders. And this is where things start to get a little bit out of my own research space and a little bit more into Susan, so you can see the nice collaboration that we have here. But what we have is GDP growth, which is a measure that you can find pretty much, you know, kind of anywhere. And it's a model where we take into consideration who the leader is in a given year in a given country, okay? And we have our explanatory variables. We have gender, so the same thing that we were looking at before. We have ethnic fractionalization, and this measure of EF, the one that we use here is one that's been used by Alicina and others. There are a number of different EF measures, and there is, you know, they have their own debate in that literature about which measure is better. We did do robustness checks on with different measures, and we get similar effects no matter which one of the measures we use. And then we also found a measure of something called level of difficulty, which basically kind of talks about how difficult it is to lead that country. So given the variable that we had in our survey that showed that people think that these diverse environments are difficult to lead, we thought that it would be a nice way to kind of bridge between these two areas. So I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. And then our, you know, dependent variables, that annual GDP growth rate. We have a bunch of control variables in here, and I actually even have the tables, but so I'll get to those in a second. Now, I want to make a couple of caveats. There aren't that many female leaders. Like, let me be very clear. We're dealing with a small sample here when we move to this national level. So female national leaders represent less than 5% of global leaders from 1950 to 2004. And in this representation here, we included queens, just so that you can kind of see that. 61 female national leaders. But in our analysis, we take the queens out, because there's a lot of debate about whether or not queens are a big power. So 18 presidents, 30 prime ministers, 54 of the 188 countries that we look at had at least one female national leader at some point of time over this 50-year period, okay? So here's another
depiction
of that.
Yes,
yes.
For the presidents and prime ministers, did you sort out, and for countries that have both, where one is more ceremonial and one is in the actual policy leadership position, mm-hmm. did you sort out and choose one, or do they have both?
Yeah, so there were very few situations where you had a female in both those positions. I think in all of our samples, it was like less than five.
Yeah.
So the way we created this measure is just if there was a woman in either of those positions.
In either. Okay.
Yeah.
That's great. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, you know, we thought about trying to parse these in lots of interesting ways. There's just not enough data.
I totally understand.
Yeah. Yes. Oh. Go back.
Actually, you were on the next
slide. Okay. This was just over time, over our time period, how it has, you know, what it's looked like. How many women do we actually have in these positions? So you can see early on, we just had queens. Queens are blue, okay? We just had queens, and we still have a few. We have less than five of them, okay? Then we can see the green is the president and the red is the prime minister. And you can see that over time, we certainly have more, right? Prime ministers and presidents. And so, you know, maybe we have some trajectory, some progress being made, you know. There's a couple of dips in there a couple of times. It's interesting. So, this is a sample, just to give you a sense, the ethnic fractionalization measure, the EF measure, mm-hmm. it ranges from 0 to 1, okay? The average is about 0.46, and the U.S. is not on here, but they're at about 0.41, so they would be, you know, kind of falling right about in here. When we chose this particular sample, there's China, Russia, China's down here. This is Liberia, which I believe is the most ethnically fractionalized country in our sample. Afghanistan, Iran, this is Mexico, right? And the U.S. would fall, like, again, like right up in here, middle here. We also have the level of difficulty measure that I mentioned. This variable measures to what extent structural difficulties constrain the political leadership's governance capacity, to what extent there are traditions of civil society, how serious ethnic, religious, and social conflicts are. Per capita GNI in the UN Education Index as a measure of the educational level. So it kind of like is a conglomeration measure of like just how much stuff is this person having to deal with respect to both the kind of politics of the country, the ethnic and racial and religious issues, etc. Okay. Now it turns out that the level of difficulty measure, it ranges from 0 to 10. We put the same countries here. So for instance, before we had China was kind of down here, but you see they're a little bit higher on the level of difficulty measure. Here's Liberia, again, towards the end here. The correlation between ethnic fractionalization and level of difficulty is 0.44, and it's highly significant, but it's not completely overlapping, right? So you can have a country that has, you know, perhaps it has kind of a high level of ethnic fractionalization, but it's not as difficult to lead as another that might have less, right, fractionalization, yeah.
Do you know if this ethnic fractionalization is correlated with the number of political parties?
We probably can find that out, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
I'm wondering what would have more, because you can imagine people would also have a theory that women would be better at managing just different as opposed to 2 or maybe 3.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're correlated, you can see if it's more ethnicity or more political parties or political.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think that there are certainly some places that have definitely lots more ethnic political parties, and that sometimes in those situations, for instance, we've looked at some data on rules about who needs to be in the parliament and things like that, and it is true, I would guess, venture to say, could be wrong about this one, but I'm guessing that in a country that has more political parties, there's probably more opportunity for women to get involved, right? There's like, you know, if you have 2 parties and there's, you know, only so many people that can rise in those 2 parties, then I would think that you would have more women involved. And so trying to disentangle that, I think, makes a lot of sense. But it raises a bigger issue, which is it just something about ethnic fractionalization that these women are good at, or is it difficulty that might come from anything, that might come from more political parties, that might come from more religious groups, that might come from more, you know, I don't know, whatever kind of differences you want to talk about. Maybe people will just see women as more effective in dealing with that because of the same logic that I'm using here. And so I would say my hypothesis would actually be, yeah, you actually might find that if we created some difference that isn't even, that we don't know anything about, and we created that and said, you know, they've made a distinction between, you know, if you have 1 inch of hair, 3 inches of hair, 5 inches of hair, you know, do you think a woman would be able to deal with this better? You know, maybe people will say a woman can deal with it better. So I think it's something definitely for us to think about, but I think it doesn't really take away from the application, right, of this hypothesis, right?
Because of the extent to which there's states that have independent budgets versus only one federal budget, you can also imagine.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of interesting, I think,
right,
fractionalization
ways that the country could be fractionalized other than ethnicity. Yeah.
Now we have only 10 minutes.
Yes.
Okay.
Ali,
I'll defer to you whether to take more questions.
Okay, let me just get the data out real quick, and then we'll take the rest will be questions. And I think I can do this relatively quickly because I think you guys know where I'm going, right? I mean, so ultimately, here's some results. So, and I'm not going to leave this up here very long, but we had these control variables: population, paved roads, years of schooling, rule of law. These are all kind of standard control variables people would expect to see. And then certainly you would see, like, you know, the more paved roads you have, positively related to your GDP growth. Rule of law, if you have a higher rule of law, you have more GDP growth, okay? But then there's no main effect of who the leader is, male or female,
okay? But there is an interaction effect between ethnic fractionalization and gender. And this is the main effect of ethnic fractionalization right here, negative, like you would expect. And then you get this positive effect, this benefit. So here's a way of showing this. And we've played around with lots of different ways of showing this to illustrate to you what we think is what's going on in this data. These are point estimates from the GDP growth based on the equation that I just showed you for GDP growth for male and females at this given ethnic fractionalization. So here's the mean, ethnic fractionalization at the mean level, and then we have one standard deviation below. This ethnic fractionalization equals zero. There really aren't, so when we start to get at the edges of this, you can imagine there really aren't any countries that are necessarily in those positions. This is just a point estimate from the equation. Right? So if you had a country that had one, that everybody was different from everybody else, right? That it was so ethnically fractionalized, this is a prediction of how well GDP growth would be, okay? So just want to make sure that I'm very clear. I'm not saying that this is exactly what the data looks like, because I've had people say to me, what country? What you talking about? That's crazy, you know? So very clearly, the mean GDP growth is 1.95. So that's what this line is here, okay? And so this data is suggesting that when you have a man, what you see is the growth starts to decline as ethnic fractionalization goes up. And for women, you see this kind of dramatic increase. Now, we looked at that and we said, wow, you know, that data is really telling. We've looked at scatter plots, we've looked at line graphs, and we do see kind of a big jump towards at the backside here for women compared to men. So the lines kind of look like, you know, whoop. It really matters at this high levels of ethnic fractionalization for the women, okay? Then we did the same thing for level of difficulty, and we get similar results where we get that same interaction effect, and here's what it looks like here. This is, again, GDP growth rate. We don't have our line going across there, but remember the mean was about right there. And it shows, again, at the average, okay, we're right here, and then with one standard deviation below, above, same pattern. Okay, and then we actually did a three-way interaction because, as I said before, these are not like perfectly correlated with each other, and we get this effect that I don't have a picture for, but ultimately it's the most extreme situations that are very difficult and have high ethnic fractionalization that you see the biggest result, biggest effect for women. Okay, all right. So we did lots of robustness checks for those of you who care about this kind of stuff. You can talk to Susan about it. You can talk to Susan about it later. Fixed effects, 5-year performance window, leads and lags. If you lag it, how many years do you lag it before and after the GDP growth? We had used alternate measures of ethnic fractionalization. We trimmed the outliers, the imputed missing data, et cetera. And we still get the same kind of trends in this data. Again, there's not that many women in the situation to deal with, but this is what the data keeps telling us. And coupled with the experiments, coupled with the past literature, coupled with this data, and I'm feeling pretty good about the hypothesis that, in fact, there is something going on here that we need to be thinking about and thinking about the implications of what this means for all kinds of things, whether we're talking about politics and how do we frame these things, how do we utilize, you know, identity effectively in these situations, recognizing what we're dealing with. And maybe there's something kind of upbeat, you know, in all of this that's a little bit positive on the side of saying, you know, maybe we do have this trajectory where people are starting to recognize that it's okay to recognize that there may be better fit for different types of leadership in different areas. Okay, I'm going to stop there. That was my conclusions. And take any further questions in the last several minutes. Go.
My comment was about the last discussion. I'm from Nigeria, and it so happens that in most ethnically diverse countries, political parties are based on ethnicity.
Yeah.
So you find that in most ethnically diverse countries, there are more political parties than there are most. So I think there will be an association, but I don't think women rise up in those, specifically when there are more parties, because it's also the men in the ethnic groups that control the say. So I just wondered.
It's really interesting because we know about social dominance orientation. We know that men are more concerned about social dominance orientation than women are, to the extent that the country, that people are worried about getting things for their own people, right, then I would suggest that you would still see men rising to leadership in those positions. But I think Liberia is a wonderful example of how bad it had to get before they realized that they need to do something different. Like, you know, they had, they, I mean, it's an extreme.
And I think we can talk about it offline. It's
yeah.
Not,
yeah.
Not a typical, and there were other issues involved
yeah.
in
yeah.
that emergence that is not typically African. So
yeah, yeah. I agree that it's an extreme example, right? And so it's not necessary, but it's interesting how extreme it was and the role, or if any, right, you can certainly construct a story of the role of gender in that situation. Yeah.
Mine's a very micro comment about your robustness checks. I wonder whether you could instrument for women leaders. I mean, right, because I know you're not too concerned about causality right now, and it's more relational,
yeah.
but could one think of an instrument? And the instrument that I think about is the best predictor of women's political representation is the election system. Is it first past the post or
okay.
is it proportional representation?
Okay.
So could you instrument with that
mm-hmm.
And get a better measure of causality?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to work, but
yeah.
that, so I'll give this more thought. I mean, is there an instrument that we can think of, right,
yeah.
that would mm-hmm. help you establish causality?
Yeah, that would be great, because we certainly have been going around in circles. Yeah, follow up with you on that. We've also thought about, like, should we try some Monte Carlo simulation, some something? I mean, like, you know, what else can we do, right, to kind of help people that might have concerns about what we have so far, right? Yes.
I think we're curious about the use of data about the queens and other political leaders.
Yeah.
It's interesting to have, obviously, from royal families.
Yes.
From, like, political leaders, might be a little bit more from patriotic leadership.
Yeah. Might be interesting.
Yeah,
so in the results that I showed you here, we took all the queens out. There weren't very many of them, actually, if you looked at the absolute numbers of queens. So we took the queens out of our analysis, and we don't take that into consideration. But I think maybe at one point we might have done a, you know, control, like, or how sensitive is the result to having the queens in there or not. And it just didn't make sense for our story, given the variance and how much queens are involved in any processing of how the country is run, so we, you know, didn't include that. So we have questions from anybody else who hasn't asked, got their question in yet? Okay, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, why did you take queens out? Because they are really good, excellent leaders, the queens, like Queen Elizabeth and Queen Anne.
Yeah.
They are excellent leaders.
Yeah, what our understanding about the queens is that there's a lot of variance in the extent to which they actually are involved in running the country, that oftentimes these queens are playing a symbolic role. And very much, you know, actually, I said a little bit earlier, I said that there may be, in fact, some role of having a woman in the position just through symbolism, that because she's there, it changes the way other people are behaving in that environment. And so I think that actually is quite a valid question. But because we don't have that many of them, and because there's still, even within them, variance in, like, what role they're playing, we just thought that it was better to take them out. But, yeah.
I did read, though, I think it was a dissertation that made an argument that
mm-hmm.
countries that had queens would be more likely to elect women as leaders because
there was
a kind of social acceptance of
mm-hmm.
women. I think they may have actually
looked
at mm-hmm. matriarchal lineages in
yeah.
royalty.
Yeah.
Was what they looked at, and they found.
Is it like a political science paper? Or?
Yeah, it was a long time ago. I think it was a political science or political psychology. It must have been
right.
political.
We certainly can look at that in the data that we have.
It was a pretty compelling, it was a pretty cogent argument. It's,
yeah.
It's probably published by now.
Yeah. Okay. One more question.
One thing that I think is really fascinating is that it raises a really interesting paradox, which is that on the one hand, it seems that these female attributes of leadership are essence. Are perceived as assets.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they are, as we well know from other kinds of studies, often the biggest handicap for women to actually make it to the top.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to start thinking about, you know, if we were to think about what to do with these results, you know, one way of negotiating that on a micro level as a woman is to say, if I want to make it in a corporation or in a country, do I have to become more male, even if that's at the expense of my female
right.
asset? Or is it actually that attacking these kind of stereotypes that hurt us on the one end but are useful on the other? Would it actually be time now to focus on the guys and say, we need the guys to become more female,
right.
because that would actually do both.
Right,
you know,
right,
mean?
Yeah.
So.
It's, so I thought you were going to go a slightly different direction with your comment, so I'm going to say a couple things.
Right.
One is in response to what you just said about kind of making men more feminine. Now, there certainly is lots of conversation about that, right? About like when men need to consider other people. They need more transformational, et cetera. And even in thinking about just as Susan and I were preparing for this presentation today and looking at the data, I said, well, you know, anytime you're talking about diversity, talking about race, you're talking about gender, there is no real control variable. Control condition, you know. So when we're making the comparisons, it really is, and I have a lot of work that's coming out on this now. It's like we have a lot of control over the interpretation of how people are seeing this. So I could stand here and use the same exact data and say to you, men are actually really messing up in situations that are diverse. They're not working well, right, in these environments that are diverse as well as women are, right? And like you could frame it very differently and put a focus on the guys and say, what do we need to do to make them perform better in these highly diverse environments,
yeah,
right?
At the same time, take the stigma away from women.
Right.
Would be, you know,
right.
In other words, return, it sort of puts a different light on paternal leave policy.
Right.
On anything that breaks down the stereotypes, not just on the side of women who now can become generals because they don't come back positive, but also men who maybe become midwives,
yeah,
or prime,
yeah,
principals.
That's right.
I think it's interesting to break down the stereotypes on both sides.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you and think that there's definitely a role and a necessity, and that our tendency is to say, how do we fix these women and make them more male, right? Like, how can, they're not competing enough. They're not taking enough risks. It's like, maybe the men are taking too many risks. Maybe the men are competing too much. Why would you be competing in an environment that doesn't even call for competition? So there is, in fact, I think both sides of that conversation need to be had, and that if you really look at the literature and how those conversations have been framed, they tend to be framed as, you know, same thing with diversity. We got to make the diverse groups more like the homogeneous ones. They're not getting along as well. Poor diverse groups. Like, maybe those homogeneous groups are having too much chummy chum, and they need to actually do their work, you know? It's like, you know, how do you say what's right in this environment, right? And so I think it's really, we have a lot of power. We all have a lot of power, in even just the way we talk about these things. So thank you guys so very much.
Absolutely fabulous. And next week we have Stephen Frost is going to present to us about his experience as the head of diversity and inclusion at the London Organizing Committee of the Olympic and Paralympic Games. So he's going to share with us that experience from practice and his ideas on a new book project. So we're very excited. Thank you. Look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you.
That's great. That's really great.